Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome back to History Hack and Pole Position. Pole Position is back, ladies and gentlemen. We are talking about lots of Polish history, and I've got some right doozies for you guys because I've gone out of the box. I know, Alex keeps saying, World War II, World War II, stop with the World War II. I don't care. I've got loads of World War II lined up, but I also got non-World War II. We've got the Piast Dynasty coming up, and today's is actually really, really interesting because I was on Twitter, spotted the book, and I went, holy shit, I need this in my life. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest. I've got Piotr Puchalski, who's an author, historian, and lecturer at the Pedagogical University of Krakow. And he's recently published this new book, this book that I've seen on Twitter, which is titled Poland in a Colonial World Order. I mean, come on, people. Would you really put Poland and colonialism together? Well, you're about to find out. Welcome, Piotr. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so ecstatic and excited to be doing this today.
Hello, Alina. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is awesome because we actually met up for coffee. Was it last week?
Yes, it was on Friday.
Yeah, we met up for coffee. So anybody who saw my Twitter with the cake, yeah, that was me and Piotr hanging out and chatting and eating cake.
You didn't tag me though, so well, I'm upset about that, but that's all right.
But it's, look, I'm so excited about this because thinking about Poland, okay, you just don't think colonialism at all. And I was on Twitter, I came across your book and I was like, my God, I need this in my life. I need to follow this. Who is this guy bringing out this totally out of the box stuff?
Well, where should I start? Well, Poland was never a colonial power. However, it had colonial aspirations. So years ago when I was working on my master's back at New York University. Oh, no, actually, that was my bachelor's. Oh, man, I'm getting old. I came upon this trivia article online, and it was about Poland's mission to Liberia in the mid-1930s, and it had a sensationalist title, Poland Wanted to Colonize Liberia, or something like that, and that really inspired me to dig deeper and understand why the Polish state and certain Polish institutions wanted to engage with Africa in the 30s. So that was the sort of the genesis of the book, my bachelor's thesis, a short article. A short thesis that turned into an article, and then I went on to do my PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the book is based on the dissertation. So that's a long story short regarding the genesis.
You know what's really interesting? It always starts with one of those kind of trivial articles. You know, it's a comment somebody makes or a joke. You think it's actually a joke. I think recently for me was I helped a young lady with her homework for Auschwitz. And it's inspired me to probably end up writing this article of like bad things written about Auschwitz. And it was some of the biggest mistakes ever. And people are reading this sort of stuff. So it kind of inspires you. Either it's a mistake or it's something just so trivial that kind of goes, wow, okay, let's do this. Let's look deeper into this. How do I change people's minds? How do I inspire people?
Right. So in the case of this trivia article I mentioned, it wasn't even wrong. It was just simplistic. They were reducing all of this down to nationalism, anti-Semitism, and all of these factors played a role in these colonial aspirations of Poland in the 30s. But that's not the whole story. So that's why I just kept digging and digging and discovered that this is way more complicated than just a way of inscribing Poland into the club of great powers in the interwar period. This is way deeper. So we can talk about that.
We on History Hack know what it's like to fall down a rabbit hole. We have all fallen down, many of them, and our listeners have fallen down, many of them. So we're all very well aware of how this process pretty much works. And then you just have to keep going. Can't stop.
That's right.
Okay, do you know what? Let's get into a bit of this history, because some of our listeners may not actually know about Poland a lot. I mean, people have been learning about Poland from my podcast, because we've been doing things like the Piast dynasty and what else did we do? Medieval history and churches and religion and all sorts of things, but we haven't yet touched like when Poland was torn apart for 200 years. Give us this very, very quick, very, very quick brief idea of what the situation of Poland was pre-1918.
Oh God, is that even possible?
It is possible. Give us, in 10 sentences, go. This is a challenge for you now.
Okay, this is a great challenge. So between 1795 and 1918, Poland is partitioned between three powers: Prussia, then the German Empire, Russia, the Romanov Empire, and Austria-Hungary, the Habsburg monarchy. So yes, the Polish lands are divided up by these three powers. There is Galicia, the Austrian partition, which in the late 19th century gets some autonomy, but it's still, you know, not independent Poland. There is, of course, the Prussian partition, the Grand Duchy of Posen or Poznań, West Prussia, etc. Kulturkampf, you know, attempts to assimilate Poles to fight with Catholicism, to fight with the Polish language and the Polish entrepreneurship, and so on. And of course, the Russian partition, the Kingdom of Poland, then called the Vistula Land after the January Uprising of 1863 until 1830. It's somewhat, let's say, autonomous. Then, of course, with each uprising, it becomes less and less autonomous. So so Poland is divided up by its neighbors. And of course, then comes World War One in 1914. So you have the Central Powers. So two of the partitioning powers fighting against the third one, Russia. And at the end of the day, they lose. And as you know, there is also the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. So the Polish leaders managed to regain independence for the country, right? Piłsudski is a central figure here, but also Roman Dmowski and Ignacy Paderewski in Paris and London, they're, of course, working with the Entente to persuade them to recognize the need for Polish independence, right? So we have Piłsudski sort of doing the military work, and then the other leaders doing the diplomatic work. And at the end of the day, Poland becomes independent in 1918, thanks to the fall of the empires, but also thanks to these military and diplomatic efforts. So probably like 50 sentences. Sorry about that.
But no, well done. Ladies and gentlemen, Polish history in a nutshell, which is kind of giving you an idea of where we're going with this. Because to be honest, I should have pulled off some other people to kind of give us this background information. So we're kind of going back to front now. So if you want to know more, keep listening in for future podcasts where we're going to be talking about like the interwar periods and blah, 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 and everything else. But right. So we are at the stage. Poland has now regained its independence. 1918. Yay. Poland placed the Polish national anthem right here. Might see if we can stick that in. Jeszcze Polska nie zginęła, because it hasn't. It's still on the map now. So Poland is now going through a total, crisis at this stage, because it's now having to reform its government, reform its economy, reform social life.
Crisis. You can certainly call it a crisis.
Because it's crazy, right, at this stage. So
that's together from at least four different political and economic systems, right?
Exactly.
Poland, the Prussian partition, Galicia. Then you have the lands in the east that had been incorporated directly into the Russian Empire. So at least four different mechanisms, state mechanisms, apparatuses you need to patch back together. So
this brings me on to a really interesting question, because, I mean, it's going through this crisis. Why is Poland interested in colonialism? I mean, where does all of this fall into it?
That's a great question. It's precisely because of this crisis. That's right. It sees colonialism, or at least some form of engagement with the colonial world order, the colonial system, as a remedy for all kinds of domestic problems, especially after 1929, during the Great Depression, which exacerbates all of these problems, right? So you have unemployment in the countryside, you have emigration, you have political turmoil, at least until 1926, Piłsudski's coup d'etat. You have national tensions, right? You have some anti-Semitism, which gets worse in the 1930s. You have the Polish-Ukrainian tensions in the East as a result of Poland winning territory back from Soviet Russia in 1920, 1921. You have the conflict with Lithuania over Vilnius. So you have all kinds of problems, but let's say the colonial aspirations are supposed to solve at least two of them. The economic problem of unemployment and what's considered overpopulation in the countryside, and the minority problem. So there you have the Madagascar project, right, which is supposed to provide an alternative national home for Jews.
Well, let's because we've got this on the list to talk about Madagascar. So, I mean, let's stick with that stuff. You've mentioned it. Let's stick with it. Madagascar, when we think of Madagascar, if you've studied the Holocaust, you think the instantaneous idea by the Germans in the 1940s to think, oh, OK, we're going to dump them on an island, or the whole Jewish population. I mean, is this the same thing? Is this a different idea? I mean, what is this project?
I would say it's related, but it's different. It's not meant to be genocidal. It's meant to be actual settlement that is supposed to provide Jews with opportunities to farm the land, to work, to live. Hitler and the Germans, they wanted to turn Madagascar into a site of genocide, right? It was supposed to be supervised by the SS. The Jews couldn't leave a certain area of Madagascar. They were supposed to basically be worked to death. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. It was a genocidal project. Here you have the Polish government, the French government negotiating a limited but steady inflow of Jews, but not only Jews, into Madagascar, starting in 1937. Then, of course, the project ends because of a change in the French government. The Popular Front loses the election in 1938 in the spring, and the new right-wing French government considers this project of moving Polish Jews and Eastern European Jews to Madagascar a danger for political reasons, because the French colonists in Madagascar are opposed. They think that the Jews will create problems with the native Malagasy, with the native population. They will be competing for the same jobs. They don't trust that the Jews can adapt to farming. So the French colonists assume that they will to towns and to take away jobs, not only from the Malagasy, but also from the Hindus, from the Indians who live there and sort of serve as this intermediary economic role. So long story short, yes, the project is abandoned in 1938. And of course, the rationale, the motive for it is partly anti-Semitic, but it also stems from this broader problem, which is agricultural overpopulation in central and eastern Poland, especially after the Great Depression. I mean, in 1935, as you know, all over the world, you have the phenomenon called the price scissors, right? The price of agricultural products falls well behind the price of industrial products, right? So these scissors. And in 1935 in Poland, farmers need twice as much produce to buy the same amount of industrial goods as they did in 1929. And also only 10% of all farms are rentable, produce profit. So huge, huge economic problems in Poland in the 1930s, and industry cannot develop fast enough to alleviate these agricultural problems, to absorb so-called excess peasants looking for jobs outside of agriculture because raw materials are expensive despite the Great Crisis, despite the Great Depression. They're expensive because Poland doesn't have access to any territories that have cotton, that have rubber, that could power the industry of wood, the textile factories, and so on. So this is the other side of these colonial aspirations, right? Acquiring maybe not colonies per se, but at least colonial concessions, economic concessions in Africa, especially in Africa, so that Poland, the Polish state, the Polish industry can buy raw materials, can mine raw materials cheaper than before. So on the one hand, you have the Jews. On the other hand, you have the economy, right? Winning colonial concessions in Africa is meant to both provide an outlet for the Jews, but also provide areas where raw materials can be obtained more inexpensively.
Well, this sort of makes sense. The economical sense, it just, it works. because Poland hasn't got these raw materials that they need to develop. So you've mentioned Africa. Where else do they end up going? Apart from Africa, I mean, do they end up in, for example, Japan? Where else do they go?
The Polish statesmen to obtain raw materials.
Or... Yeah. So apart from Africa, where else do they end up going?
Well, they import. They don't go anywhere. They import, right? They import from the French possessions in North Africa, the French protectorates, Morocco, let's say, phosphates. They import from South America. They import from the US. So they really just have to rely on classic economic channels to obtain raw materials for the industry, but it's not enough. It's too expensive. Now remember, Poland never abandons the gold standard. It needs to pay its debts back. Its currency, the zloty, is not flexible, right? So on the one hand, the Polish state has to spend a lot of money to balance its budget, to balance the foreign debts, especially the French ones, because it needs the French alliance, right? The geopolitical situation is tense. Nazi Germany is making incursions into Europe, right? So on the one hand, it needs to balance its budget, it needs to pay its creditors, and on the other hand, it needs to buy raw materials. So it's just not enough to really develop the industry.
I'm really interested in this because this comes up in your book, actually, the idea of immigrants and colonists. Can you explain to our listeners what the difference is?
Yeah. So, well, the thing is that the Poles, these Polish colonial activists conflate the two. They conflate immigrants with colonists. They attempt to turn Polish immigrants into colonists. And this is especially evident in South America. So even before the same Polish statesmen become interested in obtaining colonial concessions in Africa, they have this idea of using existing Polish clusters of immigrants in places like South Brazil, the state of Paraná, especially in places like Northern Argentina, the region of Misiones, as centers of Polish farming, as centers of Polish trade. So they think that these peasants, these people who went there to look for a better life, to improve the standard of living, can now work for the Polish state abroad and serve as these both intermediaries in trade, but also people who will mine and farm specific products. So you have the Polish state sending agricultural experts and immigration activists to these places in South America to try to consolidate them and to direct their efforts to particular tasks that will benefit Poland. This starts in the 1920s and continues into the 1930s, but for reasons of domestic political changes in South America and Brazil and Argentina, it becomes more and more difficult to maintain these so-called Polish colonies. Because there is a rise of nationalism in Brazil, especially with Getúlio Vargas coming to power. And the Brazilians, and to some extent the Argentinians, are afraid that maintaining the very Polish character of these settlements poses a threat to Brazil, right? To Argentina, to their sort of national unity, let's say. So immigrants are being used as colonists with some limited success by the Polish government into the mid-30s, not later than that. It just doesn't work anymore.
I'm interested because you talk a lot about governmental changes. I mean, obviously, Poland also had a lot of changes within government. Does this affect this whole idea of colonialism at all? I mean, we all know Piłsudski kind of sat in the background for all of this at the end of the day, but nevertheless...
Right. So the idea of using Polish immigrants as colonists in South America actually predates Piłsudski's coup d'etat. Some right wingers, some Endecja supporters are partial to this, that they support this project. However, the process of channeling immigration to South America accelerates after Piłsudski's coup d'etat. And then these same people, realizing the change that are taking place in South America with, you know, Getúlio Vargas coming to power and the whole area becoming more nationalistic and more hostile to Polish settlement, to sort of consolidated Polish settlement, these same statesmen now turn to Africa. And that's when they lobby the Polish government, now the Sanacja, the Piłsudski government regime, to work within the League of Nations and work with Western partners such as Portugal and France to persuade them to grant concessions, economic concessions, but also settlement concessions in these powers colonies, such as Angola, such as the mentioned Madagascar. So there is this shift around the time of the Great Depression from South America to Africa, from channeling immigration to southern Brazil and northern Argentina toward working for these colonial concessions in Africa. So there's actually some continuity when it comes to promoting colonial policies in Poland under Piłsudski. So, there are no major government changes in Poland. Obviously, there's Piłsudski's death in 1935, right? That's a major shift, let's say, a major change. And it does result in less emphasis placed on Polish colonial demands being put forward to fulfill actual economic aims. Now it's more a question of diplomacy after 1935. And we can talk about that if you like. Because that's another dimension to this whole complicated story.
Yeah, and let's throw that in because, you know, obviously that shift is quite interesting. A lot of people might not understand, obviously, this whole dynamic and the issue of the political shift and everything else. But give us a little bit of an idea before you throw into the colonialism side, but just for our listeners who don't know Polish history in the interwar period, give us a little bit of a background and then hit us with the colonialism.
All right.
I'm making your job so much harder today, right?
No, it's all right. I don't think I'm making my own story more complicated than it should be. Right. So, so as I said, in the first half of the 30s, the Polish state, working with this institution called the Maritime and Colonial League, these Polish activists, is putting forward colonial demands in the international forum for economic reasons, right? To obtain ways of buying raw materials more cheaply from its sources. But around the time of Piłsudski's death in 1935, around the time that Józef Beck, the Polish foreign minister, now becomes a very powerful figure in the Polish government, something changes, and Polish colonial demands are now used not so much so that they actually win colonial concessions for Poland, but to put some diplomatic pressure on the Western powers, especially Britain and France. And this is most extreme in 1938. And as you know, 1938 is the year of appeasement, right? Of course, in March of that year, you have the Anschluss of Austria by Nazi Germany. Then at the end of September, you have the Munich Conference, where Chamberlain and Daladier agree to Hitler annexing the Sudetenland. And of course, the Czechs are not even invited. They lose... their loss of territory is decided by the Western powers. So Józef Beck, this Polish foreign minister, is afraid that the same fate awaits Poland, that at some point the Western powers will sacrifice Gdańsk, Danzig, or the so-called Polish corridor, the Western Pomerania, for the sake of delaying war with Hitler. And he, Józef Beck, realizes that there is another place where appeasement can take place, when territories can be given to Hitler in exchange for peace. And this is, of course, the colonial appeasement that the Western powers did at one point consider, either returning the old German colonies to Germany or offering other colonies that Germany had never possessed before, such as the Congo, to Hitler in exchange for not going to war, right? For not invading in Europe. So the idea is to turn Hitler's, but also the Western leaders' attention away from Europe toward Africa. So this is another reason why, for example, in April 1938, right after the Anschluss of Austria, Beck makes secret arrangements with the Polish institutions promoting the colonial idea, such as the Maritime and Colonial League, to increase colonial propaganda in Poland, because he wants to show the world that Poland is interested in Africa, that it's perhaps looking for an arrangement with Germany regarding Africa or with Italy. So yes, so again, the idea is to turn the world's attention away from Europe toward Africa, so that if any appeasement takes place, it does not take place at Poland's cost, at Poland's expense, it takes place at the expense of some minor colonial powers such as Portugal or Belgium. So that's just yet another layer to this complicated
That's
story.
Sneaky. That's really sneaky.
Yeah, diplomacy. Well, that's the decade of the 1930s for you, right there.
Well, I want to touch on, obviously, I'm going to bring World War II into this, but before we go on to the World War II question, because there is one, and, you know, me, I always have to bring something to do with World War II. I want to know, is there any positives or negatives to the people that actually became colonists? Is there anything interesting that you discovered that these people did, found, or any tragedies, anything along those lines?
Well, there is actually a moment in 1934, 1935, 1936, when Polish colonists who go to Liberia consider themselves anti-colonialists, believe it or not. Yeah, they think that they're actually fighting colonialism.
I'm sorry. That's right. Can you rephrase that again? They're anti-colonialists fighting colonial. Okay, right, okay.
Yeah. pay attention.
I was sitting there thinking, hold on, wait, is he saying the right words coming out of his mouth right now?
I did not misspeak.
Okay.
This is right. Yeah, so before Yusuf Beg makes colonial aspirations into a diplomatic instrument in the late 1930s, you have the first half of the 1930s when the Poles, especially the Maritime and Colonial League, are actually trying to obtain colonial concessions from the Western powers. First, they tried with Portugal, then with France. It doesn't work. These powers are too afraid of losing their own privileges. They don't. Portugal first lets Polish settlers into Angola. Then it becomes afraid that they're going to work with the Germans to undermine Portuguese rule. So they lose their privileges. The French decline Polish requests to let Polish settlers into places like Cameroon. So the Maritime and Colonial League gets fed up, but then it encounters a great opportunity to find economic privileges elsewhere in Africa, and this is Liberia. And the reason is Liberia actually needs Poland's help because Liberia is in trouble. This is the only independent state in Africa, but there is a problem. It practices slavery. The Liberian government actually turns a blind eye to a form of forced labor, which is almost equivalent to slavery. And the Liberian government gets in trouble with the League of Nations, is about to be turned into a mandate. But lucky for it, Poland sits on the commission that decides on the matter in the League of Nations. So the Liberian diplomats secretly negotiate with Polish diplomats a deal whereby in exchange for economic privileges in Liberia for Polish settlers, the Polish government will defend Liberia's sovereignty in the League of Nations. So Poland actually contributes quite a bit to Liberia preserving its independence in the mid-30s. And this causes very significant diplomatic repercussions in U.S.-Polish relations, for example, because the U.S. actually considers Liberia its own protectorate, but that's a whole separate story I'm not going to get into.
This is becoming a total and utter mess. I mean...
Yes, it is. So, yes, anti-colonialism, right. So, yes, so in order to maintain good relations with Liberia, the Liberian government, the Polish settlers who go to Liberia to establish plantations as a result of this deal I just mentioned between the Polish and Liberian governments, Polish settlers need to portray themselves as friendly toward Africans. So they market themselves as essentially anti-colonialists because Poland had just saved Liberia from becoming a mandate, becoming a colony. So now the Polish planters, they cannot act just as any other whites in Liberia. So they try to present themselves as anti-colonialists, as sort of just friendly experts who are there to help out with the economy, to sell better products to Liberians and so on and so forth. You know, the very people who were looking to join this colonial club were marketing themselves as anti-colonialists. So just to add some more.
did it work? Do you know if it worked?
No, it didn't really work. The U.S. made sure it didn't work. It drew attention to every instance of Poles misbehaving toward Black ladies on steamers or Native workers in the interior of Liberia. I mean, the Poles, they didn't. They could not possibly have acted this out correctly. They considered themselves whites, you know, members of this European civilization that was superior to Africans. So this was a impossible project to carry out, but still interesting. I mean, still fascinating, because they often use the same discourse to appeal to Liberians and Africans as Polish Romantics did, you know, in the 19th century. Poland being the Christ of nations, the Poles dying for freedom, ours and yours, and so on and so forth. So the return of this 19th century discourse in relation to Africa is really fascinating.
I mean, that continues, obviously. Again, I'm going to bring up World War II. I always do this. It does continue, actually, in the Second World War. There have been instances that, I don't know, I didn't even remember where I came across this evidence. And you know what it's like as a historian. You're doing something, and then you find something somewhere that, you know, that you still can't remember where it was. But instances of Polish soldiers being, you know, these romantic men that are fighting for their freedom, especially in Britain. Same as my grandfather. One of my grandfathers in the 1950s, he was known as the romantic, because he opened the door for the ladies and he did all of this, you know, very gentlemanly things that other men didn't do. For example, the British or Americans or whatever. And they were kind of this exotic style of man. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I find an echo of that in an earlier period, but I'm actually starting to work on the period of World War II. I'm very much interested in Polish soldiers who served as British troops in the British colonies of West Africa in the years 1941 to 1943. And they faced a real dilemma, because they were fighting for Poland's independence, and yet they were serving in British colonies with Africans who were not granted the same political sovereignty by their masters, in this case, the British. So I really find this question fascinating of, you know, Europeans, Eastern Europeans, Poles fighting for their own independence while enjoying the benefits of being of the right skin color, right? You know, in Europe, they're reduced to slaves under Nazi Germany, but in Africa, they belong to the ruling class just because they happen to have the right skin tone. So I don't know where to go from here, but
look, do you know what, this is a really interesting topic that, once you've done your research, once you finish the book, we're going to come back to this, because this is a really, I mean, we could talk about a whole hour, let alone just on moral dilemma in this time period. We'll leave it for now, because however much I want to delve into this. Right, okay, let's go with my World War II question, because, you know, we all know Germany invades Poland in September 1939. Soviets invade again on the 17th of September. So literally 2 weeks later, Poland is divided. I'm not going to give you the whole spiel, because you've already heard me on various platforms talking about Poland and Roger Morehouse and many other historians. But there's two. I'm going to give you a two-part question, because first of all, what happened to the Poland? Actually, three-part. Let's make this more difficult for you. What happened to the Polish colonies during the Second World War? What if the Polish state was not destroyed in the Second World War? And I'm going to throw in a doozy here. Does Poland actually become a colony of Germany and the Soviet Union? So, three-part question. Go where you think this will take you.
Whoa. All right. So just a small correction. Poland never possessed official colonies, colonies in a political sense. It only supported settlements in other powers' colonies and in South America. So in 1939, upon the German invasion, you have a number of Polish settlements in the Paraguayan, Argentinian, Brazilian borderland, and you still have a Polish settlement in Angola and a Polish settlement in Liberia, and a series of Polish farms in the borderland between Portuguese Mozambique, Portuguese East Africa, and Southern Rhodesia, which is, of course, a British colony. All of these settlements fail during World War II for a very simple reason. The Polish government does not have the funds to support these very expensive endeavors. These settlements often exist in very inaccessible places, in areas that have a climate that is not very well suited to Europeans. So they're experimental farms, basically. often created for political reasons rather than economic reasons. I mean, the farms, the plantations in Liberia, for example, were purposely established in an area where the Polish planters could get in contact with local princes to incite a rebellion against the Liberian government, right? That was sort of the other side of this Liberian project that I did not mention. While acting friendly toward the Liberian government, the Poles were actually making efforts to undermine it. But anyway, that was a tangent. Yeah, so these settlements are way too expensive to maintain during World War II, when, of course, the Polish government is in exile, first in Angers in France, then in London. It has to support Polish refugees all over the world, right? It has to pay for the war effort. I mean, it still has a budget, right? It still has other expenses. So very slowly, all of these settlements are either sold to companies, to governments, or simply abandoned. The cash flow from the Polish government is cut off. So that's what happens to the settlements, to the so-called colonies. And the second part of your question was about what if World War II never happened, or what if World War II did not result in the destruction of the Polish state? Well, that question hinges upon all the possible scenarios, right? I mean, why does World War II, or why does the invasion of Poland not happen? Does it not happen because Poland, the Polish government decides to become a junior partner of the Nazi government, of the German government, and joins this crusade against the Soviet Union? Does it not happen because the British and the French decide to attack Germany from the west when Poland is attacked in September 1939, right? So first you need to sort of pick your scenario, and then maybe I can answer the question. But well, I think that yes, that I think that eventually Poland would have obtained some concessions from the Western powers. Perhaps it would have been given, you know, an area to farm coffee in Angola, or, you know, an area, a concession, economic concession, some kind of mines in the Rhodesia, etc., etc. So yes, I think it was going in that direction. But it's a question that it's impossible to answer. It's alternative history. So
the alternative history fun person. I love a bit of alternative history, just to make it more interesting, because every historian has a different opinion. And that's what makes it really interesting. I think we should definitely do a What If Poland podcast. What if there was no Polish Bolshevik War? What if Józef Piłsudski lived beyond 1935? I think, do you know what? I'm so going to do this. In a couple of weeks' time, I'm going to get together a big load of Polish historians, and we're going to do a What If podcast just for fun.
All right, well, my colleagues who are professional historians will disavow me, but that's all right.
It's okay. There'll be loads of PhD historians, because it's, look, we're talking about popular history here. This is not academia at the end of the day. Even though you are an academic, you know, it makes it that kind of thing interesting. I mean, obviously, apart from those silly programs like what was that one on Prime? My brain's gone, you know, The Man in the High Tower, for example. That was just ridiculous. But, you know, it's a bit of fun at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, I'm open to the idea.
Let's do it. Anyway, finish off our last question, because that's the one I'm the most interested in. Does, in theory, Poland become a colony of Germany and Soviet Union? What do you think? What's your opinion?
Yes. My very short and brief answer is yes.
We can sit with that.
It does become a colony, or even worse than a colony.
Let's stick with that.
I would say the western provinces of Poland, you know, Pomerania, the Poznan area, they are incorporated directly into Germany. And there you can perhaps see some classic colonial policies on the part of the Germans, where they try to assimilate some Poles who are not considered purely Polish, right? The Kashubians or the Silesians, right? They try to assimilate them, like the French did with, you know, Africans. Assimilationism, right? The French colonial policy. So there you can, so yes, so in the areas directly annexed into Germany, into the Reich. You can see some colonial policies, of course, coupled with totalitarian policies, genocidal policies toward Poles, where they are, where the intelligentsia is killed, just like in the general government, right? Where, you know, priests are killed, where the people are deported. So this goes well beyond classic sort of British style colonialism. What Germany does in the general government, however, is of course more akin to what they did in Namibia, let's say, right? I mean, this goes beyond the colonialism, which of course was at times genocidal and was something that should be condemned by all means. But what happens in occupied Poland is a genocide, right? I mean, it's a genocide where Jews, of course, are targeted in the first place, but the Slavs, including the Poles, are just awaiting their turn. So economically and in terms of human life, this is the worst possible form of colonialism. And the Soviets, well, that's colonialism too, because of course they create a system, an economic system, whereby the Polish economy is supposed to serve the core, the Soviet Union. But you can also argue that the entire Soviet Union was one huge colony, right? Where everything is, every economic system or every economic relationship is meant to propel the Soviet industrialization at the cost of human lives, at the cost of human well-being, right? So I don't even think that the Soviet occupation of the eastern territories in 1939 to 1941 is anything special. I mean, the Soviets just sort of applied the same system of exploitation to that area for those 2 years.
I'm not going to ask about post-war because we're just going to complicate things.
No, let's stop
and,
there.
I think we can talk probably for another 45 minutes on post-war. But listen, this has been really enlightening, really interesting. I've learned so much about Polish history that I didn't even think existed. I mean, who would ever put Poland and colonialism in the same sentence ever? Till you went and found that article and decided to explore it more.
Serendipity.
Exactly. So thanks to you, we have this fantastic book. Remind our readers exactly what the name of the book.
Poland in a Colonial World Order. Subtitle, Adjustments and Aspirations, 1918 to 1939.
Perfect. Go grab yourselves a copy because I definitely am going to start reading mine back to back because it's been very interesting. And this podcast has been very interesting and it's inspired me to go and look at other aspects of Polish history, not just the Second World War, ladies and gentlemen. Shock, horror, horror. There we go. Piotr, thank you so much for joining me. Everybody, go and grab yourselves a copy of this book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Alina. This has been a pleasure. Thank you.